Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. This morning, in this first hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking with David Marinus. He's an associate editor at The Washington Post, and we'll be talking about a new book that he has written. The title is Rome 1960, The Olympics That Changed the World, and it does indeed concentrate on the summer games that were held in Rome in that year, 1960. He says that in many ways, these Olympics of 1960 marked the passing of one era and the birth of another. There were many firsts associated with this. It was a time when, for the first time, perhaps not as we recognize it today, but for the first time, the games were broadcast on television. Money became increasingly important. It was the first time there were significant concerns about doping. It was also at a time when African-American athletes and female athletes were demanding and receiving greater and greater recognition. It was a time when the whole notion of amateurism was being challenged. And he says that for better or worse, one could see the modern world as we know it coming into view during these games. The book's out recently. It's published by Simon & Schuster. And if you're interested, you go to the bookstore and to seek it out. Let me tell you a little bit more about our guest. David Marinus won the Pulitzer Prize for National Reporting in 1993 and has been a finalist for the Pulitzer two other times. He is the author of best-selling works on Bill Clinton, Vince Lombardi, Roberto Clemente, and also the book They Marched Into Sunlight, which is a book about Vietnam and the 60s. He makes his home in Washington, D.C. He's talking with us this morning by telephone, and as we talk, questions are certainly welcome. The number, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That means if it would be a long-distance call, use that number and call will be on us. If you're listening around the air, on the air around Illinois and Indiana, or on the internet across the country, either way, use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. Again, 333-WILL and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Any point here, you have questions, you certainly are welcome to call. Mr. Marinus, hello.
Hey, great to be with you, David.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us. There certainly are many great stories and great characters associated with this particular games, and so I don't really think that it's that hard to justify writing a book about this. At the same time, I guess that if you look at those games that made history, and often it was because something bad happened or because politics were heavily involved, the 60 games would probably not be on that list. How was it that you started to get interested in this particular version of the Summer Olympics?
Well, you're right. The ones that would be on the list were 1972, obviously, with the murders in Munich, the horrible deaths of the Israeli athletes. 1968 in Mexico City with the Black Power salute of Tommy Smith and John Carlos and all of what that represented. And the 1936 games in Nazi Germany. Those are the three that people thought I would be writing about. But I chose 1960 because I thought it was more interesting than any of those, that those games offered a singular moment that certainly was more transcendent than anything that happened in 1960, but that 1960 was a point of truly profound transformative change that is not always as evident at the moment as it is in retrospect. And I wanted to sort of give those Olympics their due. I mean, not only did they have those phenomenal athletes ranging from Cassius Clay to Wilma Rudolph to Bebe Bikila and Rafer Johnson, but these were, as you said, you know, so many different ways you could see the modern world coming into view, mm-hmm. with television, doping, commercialism, advances for blacks and women. All of those are changes that last forever.
Now, it seems to me that that probably every time we have an Olympics, someone says something like issues a plea for keeping politics out of the games. And I guess I have to think that I think probably politics have always, to one extent or another, been part of the games.
Yes.
And certainly nations see this as an opportunity to demonstrate and to bolster national pride. And, you know, we keep count of how many medals have been won. And nations like the idea of being the biggest winner. Certainly this time around, the Chinese were seen to be very determined to win more medals than anybody else.
Yeah.
But the thing that you have to remember, and now it's the Cold War has not been over all that long, and yet it seems to be fading fairly quickly in our memories. This was the Cold War, and there was an intense rivalry at this time, certainly between the United States and the Soviet Union.
Yeah, the Olympics, first of all, anytime you have the whole world on the same stage at the same time, you're going to have politics. And the Olympics have always worked on those two tracks of sports and politics, sometimes separate and sometimes together. And in 1960, it was an intense moment in the Cold War. And the Olympics were a battleground in that propaganda war, in not just the medal count, but in so many other ways. This was a time when black Africa was getting its independence that summer, 14 new nations being born, very fertile territory in the Cold War. East and West Germany, it was only months before the Berlin Wall went up, and East and West Germany were actually forced to compete as one team, one so-called unified team in Rome. And the Soviets and the Americans were at a very tense moment. It was right then that Nikita Khrushchev, the Soviet leader, set sail for the United States to pound his fist at the United Nations and rail against the U.S. right after those Olympics ended. So you're right. In every possible way, there was tension on both teams to perform better because of the Cold War ramifications.
Yeah. One of the among the many great stories is the story about the fact that the West and East German teams competed actually as a unified team. And this was before the Berlin Wall went up. So that's you even have you take your mind back before that. How did that work out? How did the two German teams, these two teams, manage to get together and compete as
well? Well, they had to. The International Olympic Committee ruled that they could not, that East Germany could not compete as a separate team because it wasn't a recognized separate country by the West or the United Nations yet. Mm-hmm. And so if they wanted to compete at all, it would have to be as a single team. The officials, it was not a happy arrangement. The officials from East and West basically hated each other. I write in the book, it's kind of like a divorced couple coming to their daughter's wedding and having to sleep in the same hotel room. They shared quarters in Rome. The athletes themselves got along somewhat better than that. And there were certain compromises made. Instead of the anthem from East or West, when a German won a gold medal, they'd play Beethoven's Ode to Joy. Not a bad anthem anyway. But there was a lot of attempts at defections and other sort of subterranean maneuverings going on between those two teams.
Mm. I don't think there's something you directly address in the book, and I don't know if you've actually looked at it, but how it was that Rome was selected as the place that these games would be held. Is that something that you had looked at all?
Yeah, absolutely. Rome was supposed to have the Olympics in 1908. It was Rome and Athens were the two favorite places of the founder of the Olympics, de Coubertin. And he always thought that those were the two places that should have the Olympics. Vesuvius erupted before that, so Rome couldn't hold the Olympics in 08. They were then trying to get the Olympics in 1944, but of course, during Mussolini's fascist era and the war, the Olympics were canceled in 1940 and 44, so there were no Olympics. And then they went through the normal process, which, is not exactly above board, but they won the Olympics for 1960 because, in large part, Rome had always been targeted as a place for the Olympics.
Mm. Certainly the current and past heads of the IOC, International Olympic Committee,
yes,
have been from time to time, certainly have been criticized. Jacques Roga and Samaranch have certainly been criticized, and there may be indeed grounds for criticism, but I think probably they don't hold a candle to Avery Brundage, who was the head of the IOC for a very long time and not someone who comes off particularly well when you take a look at his attitudes on a lot of things. he was the guy that at this time was the head of the IOC. Let's talk about Avery Brundage.
Yeah, well, he's your guy. I mean, he's a University of Illinois graduate and was a track man there for the University of Illinois team, you know, in the aughts of 1900, and was on the 1912 Olympic team as a decathlete. He went on to become the head of the American Olympic Committee, and then for 20 years ran the International Olympic Committee. To give Brundage his due, which is not easy, he was committed body and soul to the Olympic movement, perhaps in an egomaniacal way, but nonetheless, he helped keep the Olympics together during those very difficult decades in the middle of the 20th century. He had some indefensible aspects to him, most of all his anti-Semitism. I was down at the University of Illinois at the archive there where the Brundage papers are, doing research for several days, and there are all these letters that he wrote. In 1936, Brundage was the head of the American Olympic Committee, and there was a great debate over whether the U.S. should participate in the Nazi Olympics, 1936 in Berlin. And that question is, of course, debatable, whether you should boycott or not, but Brundage's actions were not debatable and indefensible. He wrote letters to German officials denouncing the Jewish cabal in the U.S. that was trying to undermine the Olympics and saying there was a lot of negative publicity coming out of American journalists in Berlin, and couldn't they send him some clippings about all the good things that Hitler and the Nazis were doing? That was a part of Brundage that you can't get past.
Yeah.
In 1960, he had angered just about everybody in one way or another. In 1958, it's interesting to note that it was exactly 50 years ago that mainland China, Mao Zedong's People's Republic, withdrew from the Olympics altogether and denounced Brundage as a tool of the imperialist State Department of the U.S. because the IOC allowed Taiwan, the mortal enemy of mainland China, to compete in the Olympics. And then by 1960, the IOC had ruled that Taiwan could only compete as calling itself Taiwan or Formosa. It couldn't call itself the Republic of China, which was the nomenclature I'd like to use. And so Taiwan was about to boycott the Olympics, and now all of a sudden Brundage was considered a commie sympathizer. So he managed to upset just about everybody. Sometimes his obsession with the Olympics put him on the right side. Often it put him on the wrong side. And his attempts to claim that there were no politics in the Olympics was incredibly naive. A very, very interesting, complex, difficult man.
Yeah. This was another one of the things I think that makes these games significant is that it had the greatest, and correct me if I don't have this quite right, it had the greatest number of women competitors of any Olympic Games to that point.
Oh, yes, right? Absolutely. And, when the Olympics started, Baron de Coubertin, the founder of these modern games, didn't want women to compete at all. So it was a long, slow, difficult process. Even in 1960, the longest distance that a woman runner could go was 800 meters, and that was the first time for 40 years that they were allowed to even run that far. It was considered unladylike. But the women were just starting to make advances. And it was an interesting aspect to this, which is that the Cold War actually helped push women along, particularly in the United States, because women athletes in the Soviet Union and European countries were more advanced. They're more progressive in terms of allowing women into athletics. And the U.S., because of the medal count, in essence, realized it had to have better women's athletics, and so they started to open up some to women in other sports.
Mm-hmm. Again, at the same time, though, at this time, women's athletics here in the United States was really underdeveloped. This was 12 years before the passage of Title IX.
Yeah, there were no scholarships for women athletes in colleges then, very few track and field programs. And most of those were in historically black schools led by Tennessee State, the Tiger Bells, who were really the shining stars of the 1960 Rome Olympics, led by their great sprinter, Wilma Rudolph.
How did Brundage feel about women competing?
He was against, well, he wasn't totally against women competing, but he was old school in the worst way. He voted against letting them run the 800 meters, for instance. He thought it was unladylike for them to have to sweat and run that distance.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is David Marinus. He is an associate editor at the Washington Post and has written on a number of subjects. He's the author of several bestsellers, biographies, Bill Clinton, Vince Lombardi, Roberto Clemente, also known for his book They Marched Into Sunlight, a book about Vietnam and the 60s. He's winner of the Pulitzer Prize for National Reporting. That was in 93 and has been a finalist two other times for the Pulitzer. His brand new book is about the 1960 Olympic Games that took place in Rome. The title is Rome 1960, The Olympics That Changed the World, and it's published by Simon & Schuster. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Another way that Brundage was very old school had to do with his attitude toward professionalism or the importance of amateurism for the athletes. At that time, what exactly were the rules about whether you could? I'm sure you couldn't be a professional in your sport and compete. But what sort of rules were there about your financial connections and what that had to do with your sport?
You know, the whole issue of amateurism in 1960 is fascinating. Here you had, on one side, the Soviet Union and other Eastern Bloc countries with essentially state-supported teams, and that was not affected by the Olympic Amateur Code. On the western side, you had the United States and other western countries where amateurism codes were applied in sometimes ridiculous fashion. For instance, the great hurdler Lee Calhoun from Gary, Indiana, and North Carolina College, who won the gold medal in 1956 in the 110-meter hurdles in Melbourne, and then won it again in Rome in 1960, in between, he had been suspended for an entire year because he had participated in a television show called Bride and Groom, where he and his young wife got married and accepted a few wedding presents. That was considered a professionalism and a breach of the amateur code. Rayford Johnson, the great decathlete in 1960, student body president at UCLA, was told that if he was an aspiring actor and he worked out at the track at UCLA, and many actors lived nearby and would also work out there, including Kirk Douglas, who invited Rayford to try out for a role in Spartacus, a movie that was coming up, ironically, in Rome. And Johnson was very interested, but was told by amateur officials that if he took that role, it would be a breach of amateurism, and he wouldn't be allowed to participate in the Rome Olympics. To me, the interesting aspect of all of that is that, you know, there is sort of a longing for that purity of amateurism. But it's important to understand the dichotomy of it, which is that it's easy for a multimillionaire like Avery Brundage or for his executive committee on the Olympic Committee, who are comprised mostly of royalty from Europe, you know, dukes and princes and marquesses, it's easier for them to say that amateurism should be pure and that no athlete should take money because they don't need the money. But most athletes come out of poverty and hunger, and it's a very, very different situation for them. And that was the tension of that moment.
Mm-hmm. I just want to make sure I understand this. Did the Olympic Committee actually say that the athletes who were competing couldn't have any kind of job at all?
Not that they couldn't have any kind of job at all, but they couldn't have any kind of job that was seen to be giving them money because of their status as an athlete.
Oh, okay. So
it was kind of subjective and applied in some ridiculous ways.
Well, and so that certainly would have meant that, as we said, and now we have guys who are in the NBA playing Olympic basketball,
we
have professional tennis players. That's all changed. But that, I think, isn't that relatively recent that change has happened?
It's been happening you know, over the last 25 years in different sports in the Olympics. It depends on each. The Olympics, you know, you have the International Olympic Committee, but in fact, each sport is determined by its own separate federation, sports federation.
There is a good story here. You know, nowadays, I think we're probably used to the idea that athletes endorse various kinds of products, particularly the equipment that's used in their sport, and that's a way for them to make money. And for some athletes, that's really important because that's maybe their best opportunity to make some money is to wear somebody's skis or somebody's clothes or somebody's shoes. Well, back at this time, that really didn't happen, although there's a good story here, I think, involving some shoes and a German runner. And I don't know if this is the first time something like this has happened or not.
It was an early breach in the amateur code, and it was by my favorite rapscallion villain in the book, Armin Hari, who was a German sprinter. And Hari was on the take, and there were two great German shoe companies in that era, Adidas and Puma, owned by the competitive brothers Rudi and Adi Dassler. And Armin Hari had worked it out so that he ran the 100-meter dash and won it wearing Adidas shoes. Then he took those off and was rewarded by Puma to wear their shoes on the gold medal stand. Hari was perhaps the least liked person at those Olympics. He'd already, before that, snubbed Jesse Owens, the great Olympian from Ohio State who'd won four gold medals in Berlin in 1936, and had come to Rome to cover them for a Chicago newspaper syndicate. And wanted to see Armin Hari, who had broken the world record in the 100-meter dash a couple months earlier. And Hari said he was too busy to see Jesse Owens and sort of blew him off. And Owens replied, well, I've been snubbed by bigger jerks before, never by faster ones. Anyway, that was Armin Hari.
How did the IOC react to this?
They didn't know about it.
Oh, they didn't know?
No, they didn't know. It didn't come out until later. But they did find out a couple of months after the Rome Olympics that Hari had been cheating on his expense accounts, and he was suspended by the German Athletic Federation for that, and that was the last of his amateur competition. Mm.
This is also maybe the first time that the issue of performance enhancement in the sense of using some problematic or forbidden substance to do that comes to the fore. And the story here concerns a cyclist, someone who apparently took something because they thought it would improve his performance, and as a result, he actually ended up dying.
Yeah, it was the first day of the competition in a cycling road relay, and it was Knud Enemark Jensen of the Danish team. Halfway through the race, collapsed to the pavement. A couple hours later, he was dead. It was a very, very hot day in Rome, so at first they thought it might have been heat stroke. And then a couple of days later, a Danish trainer acknowledged that he'd been administering a blood doping agent to the cyclists. And there had been amphetamines and steroids being used then and before, but that single death in Rome was the impetus for all of the everything that the IOC did after that in terms of attempting to deal with drugs. They formed a medical commission because of that death, and eventually by 1968 they'd begun dope testing. Very imperfect science from then to this day, but that's where it all began because of that death in Rome.
Well, had they been doing some testing before?
None at all? None at all.
We're at our midpoint here in this hour of Focus 580. Just very quickly, let me introduce again our guest, David Marinus. He's associate editor at The Washington Post and is the author of the book Rome 1960, The Olympics That Changed the World. And indeed, it's about the Olympic Games of that year in Rome, the Summer Games. The book is out in the bookstore now, has a lot of good stories in it. If you're interested, seek it out. It's published by Simon & Schuster. And the questions here on the program are also welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, yet another way that these games stand out and in a sense says something about what would happen ever after had to do with television coverage. It was not like it is today, but it certainly had a kind of coverage that before it had not gotten.
That's right.
Tell us about how it is that it turned up on American TV.
Well, I'll contrast it with today. Today you've got NBC paying over $1 billion for the rights to the Beijing Games. CBS paid about $500,000 for the Rome rights, the first commercially broadcast Summer Games. NBC sent 2,900 people to Beijing to help work on those games. CBS sent about fewer than 50 to Rome. In Rome, it was before the era of satellite transatlantic satellite broadcasts, so there was no live coverage back in the United States. The videotape and film were put in canisters, put on the belly of commercial jets and flown back from Ciampano Airport in Rome to Idlewild Airport in New York every day. Sometimes they'd be ferried over to a CBS studio at Grand Central Station. Sometimes the canisters were so cold that the editors would have to stick them under their armpits to warm them up. Jim McKay, hosting his first Olympics, was not even in Rome. He was back in New York. And he would describe for me how he would be sitting in the darkness of the editing studio while they were cutting and splicing the film and tape for that night's show, and he'd be tapping out his script on a portable typewriter. And if he didn't know where some country was that had won a gold medal, he couldn't Google it. He couldn't turn to 100 researchers to help him get the answers. He said that he would open up the Encyclopedia Britannica for his information. And from that sort of archaic beginning is where it led to what's happening today.
Well, did that have some impact or some bearing on sports on television from that time
on? Oh, very much so, yeah. It was because of those Rome games. One of the people watching McKay was Rune Arledge, a young producer. And shortly after those games, he started Wide World of Sports on ABC, trying to sort of branch out from the Olympics to all those other sports that are known through the Olympics. And he hired Jim McKay to come over to ABC right after that because of his performance in Rome or for the Rome Games. And it was from Wide World of Sports that ABC developed its coverage of the Olympics for many decades thereafter, and McKay became sort of the face of the Olympics.
Other than that, and certainly there were print reporters there, there were newspaper reporters there, sports writers to cover it. Was there somebody asked me about this last night, and I said, well, gosh, I don't know that I would ask. Could you have listened to it on the radio?
There were radio broadcasts. Yes, but not live in the U.S. and just sort of snippets of reports. But yes, you could listen on the radio. Yeah.
And did this get pretty good coverage in the nation's major papers?
The Olympics got very good coverage in the papers. Every big paper sent at least a columnist over to Rome. And yes, I mean, I probably read 25 different newspapers for those 18 days to sort of get perspectives from different angles, and it was very well covered. Yeah.
This some of the big stories, the great stories here that come out really are stories about people. They're about the athletes that competed there, and I think that was seemed to me that's what attracted you to these games and to the idea of writing about them, particularly people like Rafer Johnson and Wilma Rudolph, both two great African-American athletes. Johnson, for example, this, again, talking about firsts, he was the first African-American athlete to be given the honor and the privilege of carrying the flag when the team entered into the stadium.
Yeah, Rafer Johnson, I think, is one of the great underappreciated athletes of the 20th century. He was a brilliant decathlete, could do just about anything, and was a man of both great athletic prowess and of class and dignity in every possible way. So he deserved that honor. He was incredibly well-respected. In 1958, for instance, he'd led the U.S. team in the first ever dual track meet with the Soviets held at Lenin Stadium in Moscow. And it performed so brilliantly in the decathlon that after the final event, the Russian crowd surrounded him and hoisted him on their shoulders and carried him out of the stadium. He was deserved to be the captain of the U.S. team in 1960. deserved the honor of carrying the American flag, but also understood that to some degree he was being exploited, that the U.S. In that era of horrible Jim Crow segregation in many parts of the United States and the rampant racism of the country was being pounded at by the Soviets for that, you know, that hypocrisy. The U.S. sort of presenting itself as the beacon of liberty around the world, which it was in many ways, but not in that one very important respect where millions of its own people, including its greatest athletes, were treated as second-class citizens. So Johnson, Rayford Johnson, became the face of the United States in Rome, and he understood that sort of the contradictions of that, but he thought that the best he could do was to win the gold medal and behave with class and dignity.
Yeah, that's a great story about the 58 competition between the Americans and the Soviets, where it was all over, and he'd got his stuff together, and he was going out to get on the bus,
yes.
And there were some Russians out there, and he wasn't sure, well, what is this? Is this a mob? Am I going to be attacked? And what they did was they lifted him up, and they carried him around and they cheered, and it was I'm sure it was a great moment for him. But right there must have been a moment where he's thinking, okay, what's going on?
Oh yeah, there was other athletes on that 58 team that came to Moscow told me about how uncertain they were and sort of frightened because of the tensions of the Cold War at that moment. There'd been sort of staged violent protests at U.S. embassies in Moscow and a German embassy there right before they arrived, and nobody knew what was going to happen. So Rayford did feel some of that, a little bit of uncertainty about what this crowd was doing surrounding him.
Yeah. Another great character is indeed Wilma Rudolph.
Yeah.
And this is someone who, when you look at her life, she is a remarkable example of someone who really had a lot of adversity and a lot of problems in her life. She actually had polio and went on to be a great, great track star.
Wilma Rudolph from Clarksville, Tennessee, one of 22 children, as you said, had childhood polio and scarlet fever. She had to wear leg braces for several years as a kid. Her mother, a maid in Clarksville, would every week take her on a Greyhound bus from Clarksville down to Nashville for treatments at Meharry Medical Center, the one black teaching hospital in the South. She overcame all of that and teenage pregnancy to become the shining star of the Rome Olympics, winning 3 gold medals. In the 100-meter dash, the 200-meter dash, and anchoring the Tennessee State Tiger Bells relay team to the gold medal. And she had such an agile, willowy, lithe style and a personal charisma and grace. And because these were the first televised Olympics, she really became a special symbol.
Yeah. And again, just go back to what we were talking about before. This was a time when women's athletics in the United States, particularly women's track, was not very well developed. And as I said, this was 1960. It wasn't until 1972 that you had Title IX, and that really energizing women's athletic, creating athletic opportunities for younger women in grade school and high school so that eventually they can move up to the point where they could compete internationally.
That's absolutely right. That's why I write so much about the Tennessee State team, the Tiger Bells, and their coach, Ed Temple, because they competed before Title IX. There were no scholarships for these young women. Ed Temple didn't even have his own office. He had to share a desk with his wife, who was the postmaster of Tennessee State. You know, they didn't have their own track. They'd have to share it with a football team, cut up with cleat marks. There were very few schools that even had women's track and field programs, mostly historically black schools in the South, like Tuskegee Institute and Alabama State. The Tennessee State team would travel in a clunky old station wagon through the Jim Crow South of that era, you know, packing peanut butter and jelly sandwiches on the trip, afraid to stop at service stations. When the women had to go to the bathroom, they'd shout out from the back, "It's time to hit the fields." You know, out of that came this the greatest women's track and field program in American history.
Mm. And it seemed that this was also at a time when people were, struggling with this notion of, is being an athlete somehow, does that somehow conflict with being a woman or being womanly or being feminine? And that it seemed that, that some of the athletes were actually at pains to try to demonstrate that, yeah, actually there was nothing unwomanly or unfeminine about being an athlete.
And yeah, it was a sort of complex situation that all women athletes had to deal with in that era and did it in different ways. Ed Temple, the coach of the Tiger Bells, had a saying that, you know, today might be considered sexist. He'd say, "I want foxes, not oxes." And the reason was because there was an assumption in that era that any woman athlete had to be sort of manly and unfeminine. And so, therefore, it was frowned upon that he wanted to present women as both women and feminine and great athletes. The Soviet Union in 1960 was trying to overcome the image of sort of its manly-looking women, and they dressed them up in Parisian dresses for the opening ceremony and made a point of trying to make them look sexy. And then on the other side, you had the incredible blatant sexism of the working press of that era. I found examples where women athletes were described by their measurements. You know, they put the measurements in the newspaper and compare them to Gina Lola Brigida. So it wasn't easy to navigate through those sexist shoals.
We have a caller here to talk with. We'll do that in just a moment. Let me give her a telephone number again, 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. And again, I'd like to introduce our guest, David Marinus. He is associate editor at The Washington Post and is author of the book Rome 1960, The Olympics That Changed the World, published by Simon & Schuster. And we do have a caller here to talk with in Champaign County, here where we are, line one. Hello.
Hi. I guess I'm back to the remark you made at the beginning about how it was so fictive that there's no politics involved. And it seems to me the Rome 60 had to be involved in some way in the Cold War and the fight against Eurocommunism, which was a later name, actually didn't even apply
right
at that point. But I mean, the documents are open about CIA's intervention in the post-war area.
Exactly.
But there was a resurgence of left right around the 60s, and there were massive strikes all over the country. This is actually reminiscent of China, actually, in a way. There is a counter-reaction against the factorization and the export mode, and there are strikes that we don't hear much about all over China, a lot of actions. And I don't know whether there are any anecdotes that contradict this or buttress this, or whether that you know of, or that, but the whole context of bread and circuses and bringing, the revenue from all over the world to Italy to be used in the whole campaign. This is maybe it may sound a little unfocused, but there's this whole context. Donner Saunders's book about intervention and subsidization of the arts, and I didn't think you'd want to go this way particularly.
Yeah, no, that's fine. There's a lot in the book about that. I mean, the Rome Daily American, the major newspaper, English-language newspaper in Rome, was funded by the CIA. Both the Vatican and the Italian communists were playing it out, the rivalries every day. And there were a lot of strikes in Rome that summer, and the CIA was intensely involved in a lot of the actions that were going on in Italy. And this was only 15 years after World War II. There were still a lot of the symbols of Mussolini's fascist era still prevalent in Rome. When I went to the assembly hall where the Italian Olympic Committee would meet every day during those Rome Olympics, the murals on both sides of that room were called the Apotheosis of Fascism. It was this frightening huge mural with Mussolini in the center and the black shirts surrounding him. So all of that was played out in those Rome Olympics, and the city was teeming with spies and attempts at defection and a lot of other types of actions going on.
It seemed the Christian Democrats right at that time in 60 were cutting a deal with I don't know if you can call them neo-fascist if it's only 15 years after the war, a fascist party to block any kind of coalition of the left coming
forward. Yes, that happened just a couple of months before the Olympics.
So the selection of the city and the country is still not very transparent, but I guess in those days it was even less so.
I'm not sure what the correlation was between the selection of the city and all of that. I do know that you know, in some ways the Rome Olympics were considered sort of the bracket to the Marshall Plan, you know, sort of Italy coming out of the shadows, and you know, but that had all those other connotations as well. But in fact, Rome had always been considered an ideal site for the Olympics. The founder of the modern Olympic movement, de Coubertin, always wanted the Olympics to be held in Rome. They were supposed to be staged there in 1908, but there'd been an earthquake that stopped that, and then Mussolini wanted them in 1944, but of course they were canceled for the war, and so it was not surprising that Rome would get the Olympics.
What year did you say he wanted them in?
44.
44?
Yeah.
Oh my. That's a.
Yeah.
That's,
well, I mean, in the 1930s, he was starting to build venues for the Olympics.
Bizarre. Thanks for the info. And just a lot of people don't know about the role of our famous Olympic alumni. And so maybe just a few words on that, and I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
All right.
I spoke about Avery Brundage earlier. You know, I don't know whether I want to go through that again, but he was very much sort of the center of the Olympic movement in that era, had a lot of attributes that did not serve him well.
Yeah, this was, again, maybe people weren't listening earlier. We were talking about the fact that at this time, the head of the International Olympic Committee was Avery Brundage, who did indeed have this connection to the U of I.
Yes.
And was somebody who was involved in the Olympic movement for – it's amazing to think that he was involved in the Olympic movement long enough so that he, at the time, was head of the American Olympic
– In 36.
In 36.
Yes, when he left it all the way through the 72 Olympics.
Yeah, that's a remarkably
right.
Long period of time to be involved in.
He was a survivor.
One other really good Cold War story that's in the book that we have not talked about has to do with the effort of the CIA to try to recruit an American runner to help in the potential defection of a Soviet athlete.
Yes, this was Dave Sim, a sprinter and a medical student at Duke University. And before the Olympics opened, he was brought down to Washington and shown a dossier. So this is Igor Terovanesian. He's a Soviet long jumper. He loves jazz and is learning English and seems very westernized, and we think he's ready to defect. Will you help us? And Sim agreed, and in Rome he befriended Igor, and they went out to dinner and talked about the benefits of the West, and the plan was that an American CIA agent would show up at the dinner and close the deal. And as both Dave Sim and Igor in separate interviews told me, the CIA agent, who went by the pseudonym Mr. Wolf, botched the attempt by scaring Igor, speaking to him in the Armenian dialect. And Igor thought he was a double agent, rose from the table and said, "Dave Sim, I trust you, I don't trust," and walked out.
Somebody else here, I want to at least make sure we get in a word about, if you think about who were some of the best known athletes of the entire 20th century, probably Muhammad Ali would have to be on your list.
Absolutely.
And he competed, and he won a gold medal in boxing. His name at that time was not Muhammad Ali, but he competed in this Olympics.
Yeah, he was Cassius Clay, man. Which he later denounced as a slave name and changed his name to Muhammad Ali when he converted to the Nation of Islam. In 1960, he was 18 years old. He won the gold medal in the light heavyweight division in Rome. He had the same personality then that he would have later, but not the meaning behind it yet. So he was kind of tolerated by his teammates as a pestering little brother type. He was full of the braggadocio he would have later, saying he was the greatest and he'd be the world champion, rhyming and all of that. He was afraid to fly. They had to give him a sleeping pill to get him on the plane to Rome, and that didn't quite work, and he yapped his way all the way across the Atlantic. And by the third day at the Olympic Village, it seemed that every other athlete from around the world knew who this young, brash American was. He won the gold medal in a brilliant fight against a big Polish left-hander. And then after he got the gold medal, he wouldn't take it off. He wore it to bed that night and walked around the village the next morning boasting about it.
And he was, I think, just 18?
He was just 18 years old.
18 years old. One other guy I also want to make sure to talk about is this man, this Ethiopian runner, the guy who won the marathon, and he ran barefoot.
Bebe Bikila, maybe the greatest story of all those Olympics. To that point, no black African had ever won a gold medal. Bikila arrived in Rome, didn't like his shoes. They were giving him blisters. He threw them away. He ran barefoot. One of the American marathoners, Gordon McKenzie, told me that before the race, as they were warming up on the Capitoline steps, he looked over and saw this skinny little guy, number 11, in a green shirt and no shoes, and turned to his teammate and said, "Well, there's one guy we're not going to have to worry about." And that was Bikila. Nobody had ever heard of him before until about halfway through the race when they discovered he was in the lead. And the amazing thing about that race, not only was he running barefoot, but he was an Ethiopian running through the streets of Rome, the capital city of the country, Italy, that had invaded his homeland and bombed it with illegal chemical bombs and mustard gas only 25 years earlier under Mussolini. And here he was running through down the Appian Way in the darkness barefooted to win the marathon in the best time ever.
And did I have this right, that 4 years later, he did it again?
Yes, he won again in Mexico, in Tokyo. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
And that time he wore shoes, the first marathoner ever to repeat. And he might have won again in Mexico City in 68, but he got hurt before that event. And then shortly thereafter got in a traffic accident and was wheelchair-bound and died a sad early death.
One certainly in recent years, I think there's been a lot of focus on the how much it costs to mount the games, how much nations spend, and whether in fact they end up benefiting or not. I think that I read an article recently. I think this was in the New York Times about the Athens Olympics, about the fact that none of the venues from that last summer Olympics have none of them have been used at all. Since.
Yeah, isn't that an incredible place?
They're just sitting there empty. And I also thinking about how one of the Olympics, I want to say maybe it was Montreal, was it 76?
Montreal was 76.
It took them, 30 years?
It was a complete disaster.
to deal with the debt that they ran up.
Yes.
So I guess I wonder, looking at the finances on this, did how much it cost for the country and was that a big burden? Was it good for them?
It turned out that it wasn't a disaster for Rome. They took full advantage of ancient Rome. The gymnastics and the wrestling were held in the ancient ruins. They used a lottery from money from the soccer lottery to finance the Olympics. In that era, the International Olympic Committee didn't really understand television, so the Italians were able to cut the deal with CBS, and the Olympic Committee only got a very small part of that. So they came out okay, and it was a combination of really brilliant modern Italian architecture. The Palazzo dello Sport and the Palazzetto dello Sport both still exist, and they're quite striking buildings. The Olympic Village was corrupt. It was built with the idea that it would become state housing for state employees afterwards. It still exists, but it turned out years later that the whole process was corrupted and there were a lot of indictments for the contractors for that. But overall, the Italians, not known for their efficiency, pulled off a very efficient Olympics.
Yeah. I'm just curious, what do you make of this story about Athens? And the fact that all the buildings that they built essentially have, since the torch was extinguished and things passed on last time around, they have just sat there.
You know, it shows sort of the chimera of the Olympic promise. I mean, every city is different in terms of whether it should hold an Olympics, whether it's capable of it, whether it will pull it off or not. And Athens was pretty much of a disaster. I don't know if you could draw overall conclusions about every city because of that, but I think that some cities are foolish to even attempt to hold the Olympics.
Yeah. Well, we're down to the point where we have to pretty much finish. I think about the fact that it seems like every time we get around to an Olympics, we end up asking the same questions about their future and whether the pure athletic event can triumph over all of the people who are looking to make money off of it and score political points, you know, and we talk about the corruption of the IOC and the process of selecting the sites and all this kind of stuff. Every time we continue to have those questions, do you suppose that we'll always continue to, there'll always be that tension between people who want to exploit the event and the people who want to appreciate and participate for the pure, athletic part of it?
I do. I think that they sort of started in 1960, that whole synergy of television and commercialism and all of the rest, and it's just grown exponentially since then. And I think they're inseparable now. I mean, even, Mike Phelps, who seems like a great guy and, truly a brilliant athlete, and everybody's enjoying watching his quest, he's not immune from that either, getting $1 million or whatever for what he wins in these Olympics. So you just have to accept that. I think you can enjoy sports even with the realization that it's been corrupted in some ways.
Well, there we must leave it. Our guest is David Marinus. He's associate editor at the Washington Post. The book, if you'd like to read it, is Rome 1960, The Olympics That Changed the World, published by Simon & Schuster. A lot of good stories there. Mr. Marinus, thanks very much.
Okay, David. Thank you. Take care.